All this week, we've been hearing how people in Illinois feel about who should be our next president, whether that's Hillary Clinton.
I want someone who has experience in Washington and who knows people on the other side of the aisle, so maybe we can break through and get some things done.
Or Donald Trump.
He's not a politician. He's not in someone's back pocket. No one's paying him off. All those issues just pretty much won me over.
Today, Politico's Scott Bland and the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute's David Yapson help us delve into the demographics behind both campaigns' support and lack of it. Do you have questions for them about who's supporting the candidates? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. Also, we speak to the woman who will become the first Asian American in the State House in Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking all week about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and why voters in Illinois support one candidate or the other. We've heard from people on both sides of the aisle. Today, we wanted to take a step back and get a better understanding of the demographics behind Trump and Clinton supporters. Joining us to talk about what's going on is Scott Bland. He's the editor of Politico's Campaign Pro, covering elections, campaign finance, polling, and more. And he's on the line from Washington. Hey, Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also, to help us understand what's happening at both a national and state level is David Yapson. He's the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Dave is joining us from Carbondale. David, welcome to the 21st.
It's good to be with you.
This is an unprecedented presidential race we're watching between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Unprecedented, I say, because most voters have doubts about whether either candidate would make a good president. And that's according to the latest Pew Research polls, among others. Scott, what are we seeing with this level of distrust or unhappiness with the current candidates?
I think there are a few trends that are emerging at this point. I think one thing that has come into the picture very recently is that while support for other candidates or undecideds or third-party candidates usually declines in polls as you get closer to Election Day, it's actually been rising so far this year. Not by much, but it's been rising a little bit, and I think that speaks to this, you know, level of distrust and unpopularity that both candidates have that we really haven't seen before.
If you have questions or comments for us about this, if you have questions about polling, about other demographics, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can always tweet 21st Show, 21ST Show. David, as we're listening to Scott talk, you've been covering political campaigns for decades. How does 2016 compare to previous presidential campaigns?
Well, the first thing is there's never been a campaign in which the two candidates are as unpopular as Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. The Washington Post has some polling out today that I think shows Trump's negatives at 60% and Hillary Clinton's is at 59%. Very close, very high. So that's unprecedented. I think it's also unprecedented the levels of anger we've talked about, the levels of fear that some people have. And a big question mark I have in this race is, will hordes of angry voters come roaring into the polls and throw the rascals out? Or are people so unhappy that they just say to heck with it and don't bother to vote?
We've been talking to voters all week, and I thought we would play some of that in particular, as you know, especially to that point about your anger, what you were just talking about, David. We spoke to Gail Hinson from Iuka. That's a town about 90 miles, I would say, due east of St. Louis. And she mentioned multiple times that she had confidence in Donald Trump because of his ability to for his ability as a businessman in terms of our nation's economy. And she talked about her experience in Salem, Illinois, and the economy there and how it's not doing so well. Let's hear what Gail had to say about that.
Back in 2001, we lost a huge factory here. And 999 people lost their jobs. That's a big number here. And it devastated this area. And it hurt me financially.
She went on to talk about a lot of the distrust that she has for the establishment. She was actually had voted Democratic up until that point. Bill Clinton was the last Democrat I believe she voted for, and then she's sort of been disengaged in the process. And I wanted to ask both of you, both Scott and David, first, David, to sort of that anger. She just said she just really felt like the reason she liked Donald Trump was because he wasn't part of these people who had ruined the economy, essentially, is what she talked about. David, how much do you think she's representative of people throughout the country and kind of tapping into what you're saying?
I think she's very representative. There's an anger, there's a fear, there's an uncertainty. The world is changing around people. There are winners and losers in the economy. And her feeling, by the way, was evident 2 years ago in the race for governor, where a wealthy businessman was elected governor of Illinois by arguing that he has experience. He's a business person. He's a turnaround manager. He can make things change. And he won. So I think there's a lot of appeal in this state for the things she's talking about.
Scott, one thing I wanted to ask you about with polling, we spoke to another Trump supporter, Dick Ibendahl, and he said Gayle was a perfect example of why he thinks polling is wrong. Because first of all, she's a registered Democrat and she hasn't voted for 20 years, so she's not being polled. What do you think about that comment? And we've heard that from a lot of Trump supporters. They think that the polling isn't accurate, that they're not getting support for Trump accurately. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's two sides to this question. I think I'd be very, very cautious to suggest that there's, you know, something in polling methodology that is preventing, actual support levels from showing up. And here's why. You know, there are dozens, even hundreds of different organizations and pollsters in different states or nationally who are using their own methodologies for finding voters. Some are using lists of registered voters. Some are calling random phone numbers. Some are doing it with live callers. Some are doing it online or with automated calls. And just the idea that kind of polling writ large could be missing something, I think, misses the point a little bit that polling is a lot of different processes happening everywhere. There's no kind of man behind the curtain in charge of coming up with these numbers.
Right. It's lots of different polls. And to that point, Scott, what are we seeing with polling overall? How much is Clinton in a lead over Trump? How narrow is that lead? How much has that changed in the past couple of months?
Yeah. So I think what we've seen in August is we've seen Clinton open a pretty consistent, I think, 6 to 8 point national lead. And we've seen it tighten a little bit in the last few days and in the last week in the polling averages. But she, you know, she's been ahead nationally after Trump, was ahead for about a week after he got his convention bounce. Clinton has been ahead pretty stably nationally and in a lot of the battleground states that we're watching at this point, and you know, including some like Colorado and Virginia that were very, very competitive in 08 and 12, where Clinton's campaign has actually now pulled TV advertising from because they don't think they need to spend the money there right now.
That's interesting. And I wanted to ask, there's a Pew Research poll, and David, I think this gets back to your point also, just about, and we heard this week as we talked to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton supporters, just a very different view of how the U.S. has changed and where it's headed. You know, I know that the polls say more than 80% of Trump supporters say life in America is worse today compared to 50 years ago. Only 20% of Clinton supporters agree. They had very different outlooks on the future. David, I wonder if you can start, and Scott, if you could weigh in. Why do you think that's significant, just this very different view of the country?
Well, there are winners and losers in the American economy. And if you're a 62-year-old white male who's been baking Oreo cookies in Chicago, and you lose your job because the company is moving that production to Mexico, what are you going to do? How do you provide for your family? It's a very legitimate concern, and it drives a lot of the trade debate. There are winners in the trade debate, but the millennials, the three millennials who get a job writing computer code because of trade, that doesn't do much good for the 62-year-old cookie baker who is just left out. And I think that that's what goes on. It's the uncertainty, it's terrorism, it's fear. In Illinois, it's you add the element of the random gun violence in Chicago. And so I think you do have the campaign operating in a couple different universes. But one other thing to add to the polling that Scott mentioned, the online polling, I've seen some indication that online polling finds a bit different response than the phone polling. And one of the things I'm watching for is whether or not people are not willing to say they're for Trump. It's not cool to be for Donald Trump. But when they go on the anonymity of an online poll, they're more likely to say that they're going to vote for it. We saw that in 1982 in a race for governor in California. It's called the Bradley effect. He's an African-American. People didn't want to tell pollsters they weren't going to vote for
him. Yeah, that's an interesting.
That's something to watch.
That's an interesting. Yeah, I think that is an interesting point. Scott, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that that's something that maybe isn't being reflected in polling?
I think it's certainly possible. And one of the things about online polling is that it doesn't have as long a track record, right? And so we haven't been able to totally test it at this point. You know, similar arguments were made also during the primaries, and I think it didn't quite. You know, there wasn't a really discernible answer in terms of, you know, whether online polls writ large or more traditional phone polls kind of pegged the results better. So I think, you know, I think it's something certainly people are studying because polling is certainly not getting any easier. And you know, the professionals who do it are kind of looking for ways to do it better. And they're going to be studying the results for sure to look for something like that.
I want to play a little bit more.
One thing that.
Go ahead, David.
I just was going to add to your question about the right track, wrong track. I think Pew, somebody has some research out today. I think it's Pew looking at the history of these surveys. Were the things better off in the good old days? And an awful lot of Americans have always said that things were better off in the good old days, that you had people in the 1930s who thought things were better in the horse and buggy era. So there's a certain element of the country that's always upset at politicians. There's also a certain element that thinks the times were pretty good in the past.
Well, and when you say that, David, I have to wonder about the racial breakdown of that, because I wonder if you asked people of different races that, if they'd have different answers to that. If you asked a white person if things were better in the 30s than a black person, if that might be a different answer.
Interestingly enough, I've seen some research that show African Americans are actually more optimistic about the country and the future of the country than
they were
voters.
About the past.
And
so
it's about the conditions now. I don't know how that breaks out in terms of are things better off today.
I see.
An African American today think things are better than they were in the past. Mm. I haven't seen a racial breakout of that.
Scott, have you?
I can't specifically think to one, but I think the point that the Pew Research poll was making about how Clinton supporters are more likely to see things as better today than they were in the past, I think speaks to that exactly. You know, the Clinton coalition relies heavily on non-white voters, not just African-American voters, but Latinos in certain key swing states and, all sorts of non-white voters. And then, you know, I think on top of that, what they layer on top of that, they're doing very well with college-educated white people where, you know, the type of folks who would have worked in, the factory that the interviewee mentioned in the clip before, more kind of blue collar workers are the ones who have flocked to Trump, and I think that just totally speaks to, this question of do you think America used to be better?
Well, and it's interesting because I wanted to play. We spoke to a Clinton supporter from Chicago, Shannon O'Keefe Matthew. She's a new mom. She's a lawyer. And for her, I think one of the most important issues for her was Hillary Clinton's support for families that she said Barack Obama started and she wanted to make sure continued. So let's hear what Shannon had to say.
When I had my son, my family was not covered under the Family Medical Leave Act. And if it wouldn't have been for short-term disability, I would have had my son on Thursday and been back at work on Monday.
And then she continued to talk about how her husband was a lawyer, but insurance was, you know, she wasn't practicing at the moment, but how she sort of felt that those policies were really important. And she also felt that being a new mom, it was really important for her to be thinking about leaders and leaders that she felt represented her family's beliefs. And she said that for her, Hillary Clinton was that. So I imagine, Scott, to your point, that you Shannon is probably representative of that college-educated, typical supporter of Clinton.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And one important thing, just kind of as an aside to keep in mind about these things, you know, when we talk about even a percentage point or two in a national poll, that adds up to millions of people. And so there are all kinds of people of all sorts supporting both candidates. But, you know, she is definitely kind of representative of a group that is leaning much more toward Clinton, you know, that maybe has often been seen as a swing vote, you know, married women, especially with children in past elections, or even leaning toward Republicans, but have been put off a little bit, I think, by the strident nature of Trump's campaign.
Mm. I just want to correct somebody. I said she was actually working, but at a small firm. Scott, we have just about a minute left before the break, and I know we've got to let you go here. Any last thoughts that you want to make about polling, about the election, about demographics? What are you watching for in the next couple of months?
I think what I'm going to be watching for in the next couple of months is how a lot of these down ballot races start to look as people tune into them, as well as the presidential election. There's a very good chance that, you know, if Hillary Clinton wins, she would be the first president in about a quarter century to come into office without control of both houses of Congress under her party, and then you end up with an immediate problem of, you know, how to achieve any of the promises she's been making on the campaign trail.
That's a very good point. Thanks for joining us, Scott Bland from Washington, where he's an editor of Politico's Campaign Pro. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're trying to understand more about the demographics of Clinton and Trump supporters. We've been talking about how much we heard this week from Illinois residents, how much that's reflective of the rest of the country. We wanted to delve a little bit deeper now into Illinois politics and how that's going to impact this election. We're going to do that with David Yepsen. First, though, I wanted to play a couple more cuts of the Trump and Clinton supporters we spoke to, and in particular, two of the hot button issues that have been involved with this election, both with Donald Trump and him being accused of being racist, Hillary Clinton and the response to the email scandals. Let's start with what Gail Hinson had to say when we asked her if we thought that Donald Trump was racist.
I don't think he is racist. No, he's not. I just don't. I think he's just bluntly honest. I do. Donald Trump is bluntly honest, and people don't know how to react to him. And that's what really I like about him.
And when we spoke to Shannon O'Keefe Matthew, she supports Hillary Clinton. We asked her response to the email scandal. This is what she had to say.
There's been proof time and time again that the server was never hacked. And I think that that's a big distinction to tell people, that there's all these theoretical. Also, the FBI has ruled that there is no impropriety. And there have been judges who have, you know, denied requests to keep opening this back up. And I think there are bigger issues. And I think that this is kind of a red herring.
David Yepsen is with us. He's the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Prior to that, David had a 3-decade-long career as a political writer and columnist with the Des Moines Register. David, as you listen to both of them, I wonder how much you think that the diehard supporters of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have just sort of decided that they're going to support these candidates and what everyone else says about them is not really an issue.
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of undecideds in this, and I don't think that there are a lot of leaners. I think if you're a Trump supporter, and I think if you're a Clinton supporter at this point, the campaign is starting to firm up. We've had conventions. We've still got some debates to go. And what you heard, the clips you used, I think reflect pretty well the sentiment of a lot of voters. Clinton's people say, yeah, we don't like the emails, but big deal. We have other more important problems. And the Trump people just look at these charges of racism and say, that's just over the top. So.
And when I think about that, David, and I'm thinking about one thing that was, I thought, as we looked across the state and we reached out and our producers were trying to find different supporters from the different campaigns, I think it's probably not surprising that we found, if we look at the state of Illinois, we found a lot of response from people in the Chicago area supporting Hillary Clinton, a lot more support for Trump downstate. That's traditionally how the state's been divided. Do you see any sense of that changing in November?
No, I don't. That's been a demographic pattern. I do think a big question is, what is the size of the African-American turnout going to be? Are people there so angry at Trump and the situation that they come roaring out to the polls? Or are they so angry that they just throw up their hands and say, they don't meet my needs. Our community is hurting and they're not responsive. So I think that's a question.
And
I think Illinois campaigns.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Illinois campaigns in recent cycles have really come down to suburban women. When Pat Quinn won the governorship in his own right against Bill Brady, suburban women were tilted for him in the collar counties, largely on the strength of his moderate position on reproductive rights. And so I think this race and other races, statewide races, oftentimes come down to who can tip the balance with that critical voting group.
And what do you think? What about suburban Chicago? Because that also seems to be a toss-up for elections. What do you think about suburban Chicago voters?
Yeah, same as the collar counties. Suburban Chicago is changing a little bit. New people moving in, other people moving out.
And much more diverse also, right? And
yes,
more diverse and actually also a lot poorer too, right? When we're looking at income levels.
Right. And so that's why you'll see Democrats making some inroads because of that changing nature of those suburbs. So that makes them even more of a target for both campaigns. These are people who may be voting for Democrats. At the same token, the people that are as unhappy as they are may be ripe for Donald Trump. And I thought last night, I don't know how many of you saw Trump's immigration
speech.
At the very end, he brought up the moms of people who have been of young people who've been murdered or who've lost their spouses to were victims of crimes committed by undocumented people in the U.S. I thought that was very powerful and a real play to the fears that many women voters have about security questions. A lot of talk about immigration in that speech, obviously, but this is one about safety and security. I thought it was a powerful message Trump was trying to convey there.
David, you know, we've heard all week from voters from both Republican and Democratic parties in Illinois. Obviously, Illinois has traditionally been a solidly Democratic voting state. Is there any reason to believe that Hillary Clinton wouldn't win here in November?
I think there's a high probability that she will win. There's not a lot of polling on the state itself, but as you note, it's been pretty reliably Democratic, and I would imagine that the pattern you just described earlier, big Democratic margins in Cook County, Trump doing better downstate, battle for the suburbs. I think it's likely that Clinton will carry Illinois. Big question is, though, what happens down on the ballot?
Right. And I think that's an interesting question, too, is down on the ballot, David, and also then as we think about all of the rancor that's happened in this state between as you were, and I wanted to get back to this. You brought this up before the break, Governor Rauner, and how much Governor Rauner was elected because people believed that he was a businessman who could fix the state of Illinois. And now when we fast forward to a couple of years later and we look at the fiscal situation that the state is in, the ever deepening bitter partisan divide between Governor Rauner, Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan, and how that's sort of playing out. Do you have any sense of if you think this would have anything? I wonder if you think this would have anything to do with the presidential election or more, if this would be affect more down ballot races, whether those are state races or even if you think, I don't know if you think that would have any effect on the key Senate race that we're looking at or any other race, congressional races.
Well, Governor Rauner's money is having, he's pouring his own personal wealth into a lot of these legislative campaigns. He needs to, I doubt that he's going to pick up, the Republicans will pick up the House or the Senate, but he might be able to pick up one or two seats
in the state House.
In the state House, yeah, and keep the Democrats from having a working supermajority. He can peel off a couple people. I think, you know, it's interesting. Voters, they're upset with the way things are. They don't like the politicians, so they're searching for something new. And they go, oftentimes they're attracted to candidates who are self-made and who are wealthy and are business types. And in sometimes they have great success, other times they don't. I mean, in Pennsylvania, the governor there has had problems with the legislature, in Michigan, in Florida. So voters are clearly in a mood for change, but then you elect somebody to high public office and ask them to commit politics and work, cut deals and make things happen, and they don't have the skills to do that.
David, it's an interesting question, too. Yeah, do you think voters compartmentalize? Do you think that the voter in Illinois, like, do you think people care? Do you think people think, well, the problems in Illinois are state problems? I'm going to vote. Do you think they split tickets or they think I might be mad at Governor Rauner or I might be mad at Speaker Madigan? Does that even affect how people vote nationally, or do people just compartmentalize that?
Well, I don't think. I think top races like the race for president or a race for governor, that's about the personalities involved. People can be unhappy with Bruce Rauner, but, you know, the old rule in politics, you can't beat somebody with nobody. So who are the Democrats going to field next time? And it comes down to personalities and how people feel at the gut level in a lot of these races like the presidency or a Senate race or governor. Down ballot. That's where a party that has the wind behind it, you're getting out Republicans or you're getting out Democrats, or they're getting to the polls. That's where you can make a big difference in the outcome of races.
Well, who has that right now in Illinois? Does any party have that?
I would say the Democrats. I think they're better organized. And I don't have a sense that the Republicans in the Trump campaign have got what they call a very good ground game. Using data, finding people who are not registered to vote, persuading them. I just think the Democrats are more experienced at that, and that means they're going to be more likely to win some of these close races.
Well,
watch the race for state controller.
Mm-hmm,
that's one
for comptroller.
A lot of people don't know. Yeah, but that could be one that's impacted by who has the best get out the vote operation.
Mm, interesting. As you talk about the establishment, the Democratic establishment, certainly Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, is going to be in the Quad Cities on Monday for a Labor Day picnic. We've sort of already seen the lineup of politicians who will be with her: Senator Dick Durbin, Senate hopeful Tammy Duckworth, who's running for current Senator Mark Kirk's seat against him, State Treasurer Mike Frericks. Is it noted to you the absence of someone like Speaker Madigan in that group? I don't know whether or not he's going to be attending something like that. I just, from the list I've seen so far, I don't see him there. But I wonder about the Democratic establishment and how much that organization, as you've said, and that sort of ground game and that infrastructure that exists, how much that will also be kind of the linchpin for Hillary Clinton in Illinois.
Speaker Madigan is a very smart politician. Whether you like him or not, you have to concede that. And he understands he's got some negatives. I don't see Speaker Madigan showing up at a lot of candidates.
Right. He's not a particularly public person to begin with. Right.
That's right. So, you know, you have the Quad Cities media market is a good one for Democrats in Illinois to be in because there's a lot of Democratic voters over there. It's also Iowa is probably one of the closest states in the country. Clinton's lead is only 1 point. It's a good place for Democrats to be on TV.
We're getting to the Senate race. I'm just curious your thoughts about that. Representative Tammy Duckworth is in the Champaign area today at Parkland College. What do you think is going to, how do you think that race is something that's being watched nationally as there's been so much interest over Republican and Democrat control of the Senate? What do you think is going to be the defining factor in that race, David?
I think that that's the Democrats' best opportunity to pick up a seat. I think both parties recognize that, which is why we're not seeing a lot of advertising on television about the race. You know, Senator Kirk got elected in a big Republican year in 2010. This is not such a big Republican year in 2016. It's a presidential year, big Democratic turnout. The second thing is I think he's been sidelined by his health. He had that stroke. He's just has difficulty waging the sort of campaign that it would take to come from behind in a race. And so the political community generally, I think, it sort of expects Tammy Duckworth to pick that seat up for the Democrats.
David, I'm curious because you talked about how for the presidential candidate, people sort of go with their gut. They go with personality. They go with people they like. Do you think that makes a difference for Senate races also?
I think so. I think Senate races tend to be a little bit of an ideological contest. And Tammy Duckworth, progressive Democrat, Democrats mad at Bruce Rauner, insurgent, got a better organization. I think that that helps her.
David, we started this conversation both at the beginning of this week and this hour today talking about how unprecedented the levels of mistrust that there are in both of the candidates. And I wanted to kind of wrap up this whole week by asking you about what you think needs to change in terms of candidates and the tone. Do you think, I mean, first of all, let me start by asking, are you worried that there isn't going to be the turnout that we would normally expect this November because of the lack of confidence that both parties are expressing in their candidates?
I think so. And I think one thing to watch is how the Green Party candidate and how the Libertarian candidates do. Do they become more appealing to voters? Voters are looking for solutions. They're not into rhetoric and all this negativity. They're looking to see who can make government work and produce results. And so that's here in the end game what we have to watch for. Lately, though, it's just been one round of negativity versus another.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what would you like to see happen? I know that's always there's a question of what you would like to see happen versus what you would actually think happen. But given your longtime experience covering political campaigns, what would you like to see both the Trump and Clinton campaigns do in the next 2 months before the election?
I'd like to see him be more positive about what they want to do. Whether you agree with Donald Trump or not on immigration, he was being specific last night.
Mm-hmm. Lots of details. Mm-hmm.
For immigration. Hillary Clinton has done that, too. I'd like to see more of that. But having said that, you're right. I have covered politics for a long time, and I understand the game at this point is oftentimes we can't make our candidate more positive, so we have to drive up the other guy's negative. And that pretty quickly becomes a race to the bottom. It's really hard for me to see how much more negative this campaign can get in the next 2 months, considering how low it is right now.
Realistically, do you think that's the direction we're going in?
No, realistically, I'm not looking for a lot of positive. I'm not hopeful, but optimistic that we're going to see a lot of positive campaigning here at the end.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. David Yepsen is the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. To David's point about the Green and Libertarian parties, next week on the 21st, we are going to be talking to folks who are part of the Never Trump and Never Hillary campaign. So tune in to the 21st for that next week. In the meantime, all of these conversations we've got at our website at www.21stshow.org. If you want to take a look at as we've been talking to folks throughout Illinois this week about the presidential campaign, what they think. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The attempt by supporters to overhaul the way legislative districts are drawn in Illinois isn't over, even after the Supreme Court's decision that the attempt to place this issue on the November ballot was unconstitutional. Yesterday, the Independent Maps Initiative said they were asking the Supreme Court to reconsider the case. In the meantime, former Governor Pat Quinn and current Governor Bruce Rauner have their own efforts to reform the way our maps are drawn. Matt Dietrich's been following all of these developments as the editor of Reboot Illinois. He's on the line with us from Springfield. Hey, Matt, welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks, Nyla.
Briefly, can you remind us just what the Independent Maps Initiative is trying to do, what they are trying to get on the ballot in November?
Right. The Independent Map Commission gathered almost 600,000 registered voter signatures over the past year, and they're trying to get an amendment onto the November 8th ballot that would change the way that Illinois House and state Senate districts are drawn every 10 years after the U.S. Census. And currently, the way it works is the maps are drawn by they're drawn by the party in power, essentially. So the Democrats have drawn the last two maps, and then Illinois has a crazy system where if you have an argument and there's a dispute between, say, a Republican governor and a Democratic General Assembly over the final maps, it generally goes down to drawing a name out of a hat that decides which party gets to draw the maps. It's a huge, huge, huge prize for the politicians because they can draw districts that lump voters into certain districts. They can draw lawmakers that they don't like out of their districts. They can do all kinds of things. The amendment would create an independent commission to do this that would have no political leanings whatsoever.
So the idea was the Supreme Court said this was unconstitutional. This gets into a lot of more kind of arcane legal reasons.
Yes.
Why. Is there a plain English way you can explain why the Supreme Court said this was unconstitutional?
Plain English way is that in Illinois, if you're a citizen and you want to go gather signatures to change the Constitution, you can only do that to change the structure and procedure of the General Assembly, okay? You cannot do it to legalize marijuana or change the speed limit or do any of this other stuff that you see happening in other states. It's only the structure and procedure of the General Assembly. The Supreme Court ruling said that because the Independent Map Amendment picks out the Auditor General of the state and gives that office a role in its independent commission, that it's gone beyond the bounds because the Auditor General is not part of the General Assembly. And what the independent map people are doing this week, what they've asked for, is they want a rehearing because they say that that is inconsistent with another part of the decision, which says that you could easily find somebody else who's not the Auditor General from outside the General Assembly to do this. So they want to redo. They want to redo. Yep.
And let's remind everybody that last week's decision was a very strict partisan vote. Democrats 4-3 over the Republicans saying we don't want to consider this. Now, there's all of these other ideas that are floating out there. Governor Bruce Rauner, former Governor Pat Quinn.
Yeah.
Governor Pat Quinn, as you have pointed out, has some authority to talk about how to get these issues on the ballot because he's the only person who's ever been able to do so. What's Governor Pat Quinn suggesting?
Well, Governor Pat Quinn on Tuesday held his own press conference and said that what it came down to was he thought the Independent Map Amendment was too complicated. And kind of what I took between the lines was, by making it so detailed and so complicated, you were just inviting the justices to find
ways to
pick it apart. And he proposes his own, which is much simpler. Now, there are problems with Quinn's because what the problem in Illinois is that you always end up in a deadlock, and it always ends up being politically resolved. And his plan has the Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter. And as we've seen, you know, the Supreme Court is not exactly a politically independent entity. These are elected justices that we have. So there are problems, in my opinion, and I think in a lot of other people's opinion, there are problems with Quinn's plan, too.
Well, and isn't it too late? Is it too late to get this on the ballot?
That is a question that I've had, too, because I was under the
understanding
that that last Friday was the day that the Board of Elections had to get the ballots ready. Now, I'm assuming since they're doing this, and they have a whole lot of lawyers on their team, I'm assuming that there must be a way to still, if they can get this, which, by the way, there has not been, the Supreme Court hasn't granted a rehearing in 10 years.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, this is not like a 50-50 shot.
So let's go to the third proposal for this, which is what Governor Rauner is, because he's also been very actively outspoken,
yes,
saying this needs to be redrawn.
Right.
What's his idea?
Rauner was a big supporter of the current independent map amendment, that the one that they're trying to get before the Supreme Court again. What he wants is, he wants the Illinois General Assembly, when it comes back to Springfield the week after the election in November, he wants the General Assembly to take this up and put redistricting reform on the 2018 ballot before voters. Keep in mind, Nyla, that in Illinois, if you want to change the Constitution, there are two ways you can do it. One way is citizens can gather signatures. And like I already said, if you're going to do that, all you can do is change the structure and procedure of the General Assembly. But if you get 3/5 of the General Assembly to vote on an amendment, they can change anything in the Constitution. They can put anything they want on the ballot.
What is the likelihood of that happening, Matt?
Well, House Speaker Michael Madigan has been a very, very, very outspoken opponent of redistricting reform. So I see it as unlikely, but not impossible, only because this gets into this crazy tie-breaking situation we have. If Bruce Rauner or another Republican is elected governor in 2018 and we have the current system in place, what that's going to do is when the next map is drawn, we'll probably have the same old situation where they end up in a deadlock, Republican governor versus Democratic General Assembly. They're deadlocked. The Secretary of State's going to have to draw a name from the hat, and it gives the Republicans a 50-50 chance of being able to draw the whole map. The last time they did that was in 1991. That map led to House Speaker Michael Madigan losing his House majority for the only 2 years since 1983. So drawing that map is a big deal. Now, it could be that maybe Mike Madigan, Senate President John Cullerton, who's also in favor of the current system, maybe they will see, hey, look, number one, there's a risk that Rauner might draw the name and they get to draw the whole map. Number two, by now we've got 600,000 registered voters signed this thing. There's momentum for it. It's coming. Maybe we should do something on our own. You know, it'd be great if the House voted on a really, really good redistricting reform measure that was sponsored by Jack Franks, who's a Democrat from up in McHenry County. The House voted on it, and that was a really good bill. It was endorsed by Independent Maps. The problem is the House passed it, and then the Senate did their own version of redistricting reform. The two never, ever got to each other's chamber, and therefore redistricting reform died in the General Assembly.
All right.
Maybe they will reconsider that.
Maybe they will.
I think it's unlikely.
I know if they do, you will be paying attention to it. Thanks for joining us, Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois, talking to us about all of the redistricting. Thanks so much for that, Matt.
Thank you, Nyla.
You know, it was interesting. We were just talking about how legislative maps were drawn. We're going to go to actually the second district now in Chicago. And that's because Teresa Ma will be the first Asian-American lawmaker in the state of Illinois come November representing that district. She's not yet in office, but she's the presumptive lawmaker because she's running unopposed in that Chicago district. And she joins us now. Teresa Ma, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Nyla.
It's interesting, as we were just talking about those maps being drawn, because your district, the second, was drawn specifically not just to be Chinatown, but it also includes Bridgeport and McKinley Park, a few other neighborhoods. How much do you think it took from the Asian American community for you to be elected?
Well, the Asian American community makes up about a quarter of the population in my district, and their participation was really key, but I also got a coalition of supporters from all over the district and beyond, and the only way I was able to win was to bring together diverse groups of people, talk to people all over the district and get their support. So it's a combination of, you know, having strong turnout from the Asian American community for the very first time, in fact, and then getting support from a broad coalition of voters all across the district.
Mm-hmm. And of course, obviously, you're representing all of the people within your district. But what do you think it means for you to become the first Asian American lawmaker in the state house? What do you think that means for the Asian American community in Illinois?
Well, it's really exciting. So we're talking about having somebody from the Asian American community represent them in the General Assembly for the first time in our state's history. And so it means a lot, actually. It's great.
Is it something you think about?
I'm honored to be in this position.
Yeah. Does it sort of?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I started my career as a college professor, and among the various courses I taught, I have taught Asian American history. And I think that, you know, the reason that it's taken this long, you know, we're in 2016, and, you know, it has to do partly with the immigration laws, naturalization laws that, you know, kept Asian immigrants from participating as full citizens. And so that set us back in the process of being incorporated into our democracy.
Well, and I'm also thinking about, you grew up in California, where Asian Americans holding government office is certainly nothing out of the ordinary. In fact, when we think about the first Asian American to ever hold office in Washington came from California in the 1960s. So what was it like for you coming to Illinois and seeing that there was not that level of representation within the state house?
Well, it gave me a sense of urgency that something needed to change. And I came here 25 years ago to get my PhD in history. I studied 20th century U.S. history at the University of Chicago. And, you know, the focus of you know, studying history is to look at the actions of people, you know, human agency making change in their society. And so that was something that really had an impact on me. I think that at a certain point it became important to actually, you know, be one of those actors in history and to try to make a difference.
Do you think that it's interesting? I'm just thinking about the conversations we've had over the past couple of days about national politics. I'm thinking about previous conversations we've had about women in Illinois politics, and they talked about how important it was for them to have women who came before them, like Judy Bartopinka, who was certainly someone who was known for giving other female legislators advice. Do you think it's really important for people who may be underrepresented to have those figures or have role models that they can see, whether that's younger generation or otherwise? Do you think that encourages more people to run for office?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, you pointed out earlier that I grew up in California, and having those role models made me think that, okay, well, that's not something that's impossible to achieve, that, you know, it is within the realm of possibility. And I've had a lot of people come up to me and say that, you know, they thank me for running, and I think it does make a difference to be able to see someone who looks like you, you know, doing something that is out of the ordinary. And I think also running a campaign, you know, I've been able to include people who have maybe felt left out of the process before, so that, you know, there are more participants in our democracy. I've been able to recruit volunteers and give them the experience of phone banking or door knocking or getting people involved in fundraising for a campaign or even turning out to vote. You know, I've had so many people come up to me and say that, you know, they've been registered for many years, but you know, last March was the first time that they actually turned out to vote.
Because that's interesting.
They never felt like there was anybody, you know, that their vote would make a difference.
Well, it's a whole other conversation about the Asian American vote and how much that will matter in the fall. Maybe we'll have you come back and talk about that. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for joining us. Teresa Ma is a Democrat running for a state House District 2 representing Chicago this fall, assuming she's elected. You don't have any opponents, so I assume that will be the case. The first Asian American lawmaker in the state of Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.